This week, I'm joined by Michael Gubser, who is a 2021 to 2022 Guggenheim Fellow and a Professor of European History at James Madison University in Virginia. In this episode, we talk about his book, The Far Reaches: Phenomenology, Ethics, and Social Renewal in Central Europe, alongside discussions on Marxism, Heidegger, social ethics, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support the podcast and gain access to some exclusive content, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Michael Gubser, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to be discussing your book, The Far Reaches, Phenomenology, Ethics, and Social Renewal in Central Europe, which was published by Stanford Press. And this, in short, is a book which is chronicling the history of phenomenology, which is overlooked when one goes to study the philosophy of phenomenology, which is to say, when one goes to study phenomenology, generally speaking, I'm sure there's courses out there that might focus on the other aspects, but generally speaking, one will find oneself in the depths of Brentano and Husserl at the beginning in a very abstract philosophy, which you wouldn't think could be connected to ethics and, as you say, social renewal and social problems. It would seem like a bit of a leap to connect the two, but actually, what your book is really chronicling is the fact that this history has been overlooked in a certain sense, and phenomenology actually has a lot of great philosophy around, we say, a phenomenological ethics or a phenomenological social ethics. So, before we jump in with the book and with this form of ethics in phenomenology, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how this book came about.
Well, first, James, thank you very much for the introduction and for inviting me onto this podcast. Let me give you just a bit of background on how I came into this. As with most books, I suppose, it's a mix of intellectual interests and sort of chance, right? And there's a very personal story to it. The Far Reaches actually grew out of the first book that I wrote, which, and it dovetails with your academic background, James, which looked at art and art history in turn of the century Austria. So one of the founders of the art historical discipline was a figure named Alois Riegel. And I looked at Riegel and his concept of time and history, but I also looked at Riegel's teachers and those figures who were around him. One of Riegel's professors who influenced him considerably was Franz Brentano. Brentano is often considered he's certainly not the founding father of phenomenology, that's clearly Husserl, but sort of a grandfather of phenomenology, right? In fact, it was Brentano's concept of mental inexistence or intentionality, the idea that every thought is a thought of something, so subject is always connected with object. That was a kernel of phenomenology and overcame. In modern Western thought, we often talk about the divide between subject and object that is associated with Descartes. Mm-hmm. Brentano reached back to medieval philosophy and recovered this notion of intentionality, and this became cornerstone of phenomenology for Husserl. Right? The idea that there's not a divide between subject and object, but every thought, every feeling is a feeling of something, so they're connected. So with Riegel, in the Riegel book, I argued that there was a sort of proto-ethics, a kind of ethical kernel to Riegel's thought and to the thought of Brentano and other figures around them, but I didn't really develop it there in that book. And so that became the seed of The Far Reaches. I thought, okay, how from phenomenology, which I, like many others, associated with a kind of abstract philosophy of consciousness or of logic, right? How is it that this seemingly abstract school of philosophy could give rise to this kind of strong ethical feeling? And that was what gave rise to the book. I will also say there's a personal dimension in that in my PhD oral exams, my advisor, sort of out of the blue, decided to prod me on phenomenology. This is long before the book was even a germ in my head. And so I ended up 15, 20 minutes answering questions on phenomenology that went well. So in a way, I came back to the moment of my oral exam, that nerve-wracking moment, and thought, well, okay, that's telling me something. And now that I've got this phenomenological question, there's my next book. So that's how I got to the far reaches. The final thing I will add, I come to it as a historian. So I am an intellectual historian by training, so tracing the history of ideas and the context in which they were written, not a philosopher per se. I mean, obviously, intellectual historians have to grapple with the nuances of philosophy, but I do think that's important to note, that what I was looking at, what I was trying to investigate, was the historical impact, both on intellectual life and, as this book traces, a phenomenology, both on intellectual life in the 20th century and on politics and activism. Mm-hmm. And that was a centerpiece of the book. To do so, I obviously had to look at key thinkers, Husserl, Shaver, Brentano. But it was also important for my work to be able to track the influence of phenomenology beyond rigorous philosophers and look at figures who are primarily activists, political figures. Someone like Václav Havel, who was a dissident, right, in Czechoslovakia and became the president of post-communist Czechoslovakia, who was, of course, a playwright and intellectual, but whom no one would consider a rigorous philosopher. There are others in this camp. And so I think that was important, you know, as a historian, that I came at it looking not just for sort of pure philosophy or you know, the highest articulations of phenomenology, but I was looking to try to trace its influence, even in more diluted forms, outside of philosophical scope.
And phenomenology is certainly a history that does seem to draw a lot of people into its sort of gravitational pull in that way. But before we jump into this you know, the beginning of this history of why phenomenology, that the study of it might have split and one side is sort of ignored, I do have to ask you the hermetics question. You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
I thought about this when you sent me the questions ahead of time, and I have one prior question for you. Am I required to pick phenomenologists?
Oh, no. That's why I said, okay, used the word thinkers, because you can put anyone in the room, really.
Good. So, you know, if you ask me this tomorrow, it might be a different group of thinkers, and the day after, it might be a different group of thinkers. But I thought, what would be a kind of fireworks, crazy, chaotic meeting? So I thought, Plato / Socrates, right? So this sort of thing together with, you know, I tried to pick someone who would really send off fireworks. So I thought maybe Michel Foucault and Plato, Socrates. And then I thought, who would the third be? I guess it might either be Marx or Hegel, for those three. I just think, and then to listen to that, I have... The combination of mutual respect and detestation and fireworks, and it just struck me as it would be a remarkable meeting.
I mean, that's interesting. I have a question from that. Is do you see in future years Foucault being perhaps seen in the same sense as, maybe not Plato, I mean, that would be something, that would be a big stretch, right? But Hegel, you know, do you see him as being canonized in that fashion?
I think that Foucault is already on the way to being canonized. It's interesting to think of him with Hegel, because of course what both Hegel and Foucault do in radically different ways is try to incorporate some understanding of history into the study of thought systems, right? Obviously radically different ways, but I wonder if in 100 or 200 years the late 20th century continental thinker who will be considered most prominent, you know, sort of post-Heidegger, would be Foucault. I mean, who would vie with him? I mean, Derrida, Levinas. But I wonder if Foucault might not come out as the one who has the most lasting effect, in part because he crosses disciplines in a way that, I mean, of course, so does Derrida, so do they all, but But he crosses disciplines in this really fraught, intriguing, ways.
Mm.
You know, as a historian, also maybe I come out of that, and as someone who went to school at Berkeley, where Foucault's legacy loomed large even 10 years after his death, and so that may be part of it. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember looking, you know, I can't remember where it is online, but Foucault is, you know, he has the greatest number of citations ever by a long margin.
Ever?
Yeah, ever. I think he's
Goodness.
Like three times beyond Einstein, who I think is second.
Okay.
But it's for that reason that you said, is that because he crosses sociology, anthropology, philosophy,
right.
history of sexuality, history, that
right.
he's you know, he's just, I guess not in a lazy way. You don't just quickly use some Foucault, but
right. Well, I wonder if the citation speaks to fashion as much as intellectual potency. But still, yeah. I mean, I think it'll last. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll try and do a segue from speaking of history. You know, history in the sense that it's been somewhat. As we were speaking of canonized in a very strict sense for phenomenology of, you know, if you think of phenomenology, people are default just thinking of, you know, Husserl's logical investigations or
right.
this very strict form of very rigorous, non-social, non-messy ethical stuff. Why has that side of phenomenology been ignored?
Yeah, I mean, let me put that in context a bit. I mean, clearly phenomenology has been canonized in philosophy and in the history of philosophy. But I think generally it's been canonized as a backdrop to what are seen as later more potent social philosophies. And you know, in part, there is, of course, an interest on into the 20th century in cultural theory and social theory writ large. And in this story, yes, phenomenology appears, but it appears as a backdrop. Husserl in particular as an extraordinarily important figure, right, who breaks down Cartesian thinking and the like, but he's often seen as this kind of last gasp of an effort to achieve a kind of perfect knowledge, right, a perfect grounding for knowledge. A last gasp in that sense of the Cartesian project, despite this intentionality that breaks it down. And those who come after, right, all of whom are profoundly influenced by phenomenology. And here I think Heidegger, who of course is a phenomenologist, but in some sense tries to break within himself as an ontologist, Levinas, who moves beyond ethics, but certainly the post-structuralist movement, Foucault, Derrida, all of them cut their teeth on Husserl at the beginning, right? I mean, so many of them have these early works on Husserl in which they, on the one hand, embrace the rigor of the project, but on the other hand, declare it a failure, right? In some cases, this is it's almost a story of, you know, when you have friends like these, who needs enemies kind of thing, right? None of these sort of prominent figures of mid to late 20th century thought, from Heidegger to Foucault to Derrida to Levinas and on, will deny the potency of Husserl, but they will also all sort of define their projects in counterposition to him, to say that what we've done is we've recognized the fallacies of an attempt to achieve a kind of perfect awareness consciousness, a perfect grounding of knowledge, and we're moving beyond it to a new project, right? So he is in effect relegated to the, you know, to the final figure to bypass. So in doing so, of course, what is overlooked is, as you say, some of the social and ethical aspects of Husserl, but also the much vaster range of, and here I will focus on Central European phenomenology, the much vaster topical range of Central European phenomenology and the thinkers we don't hear of. It's certainly true that even if you go back to Herbert Spiegelberg's two-volume book, his second volume focuses on French phenomenology. French phenomenology is essentially inherited the prominence that was due to Husserl in the beginning of the century. But in the process, of course, they tried to move beyond Husserl's phenomenological project and into something that over time became post-structuralism of various forms, various forms of later ethical philosophy that supposedly bypassed Husserl. And so in that regard, you overlook a lot of the riches of German phenomenology. And what's also overlooked is that the way that there was another migration of phenomenology, not West. And Herbert Spiegelberg's book focuses on the movement from Germany West to mm-hmm. France. Ed Bering's book also moves from Germany West and South to a degree, right? To Spain, to Italy. But what gets moved is this, what gets overlooked is this equally powerful and potent move to the East, right? To Czech thinkers, to Polish thinkers. I mean, the obvious reason is, of course, these were for a long time barred from the circles of Western thought and participation in conferences. Certainly Derrida was engaged with Czech thinkers and there are other figures in phenomenology, Jean-Luc Nancy and others who knew about Polish thinkers. But largely these were cut off. And so we are still only in the process of reintegrating, you know, European intellectual history by understanding the ways that East European thinkers engaged with continental schools of thought, right? Ed Bering's book, and I know you spoke with Ed Bering, is central to this process. And that was part of what I was trying to do in the Far Reaches, is to show that, you know, there's this other trajectory of phenomenology. It moves to the East, and in East, it's the ethical, the humanist, the political, the activist components that really come to the fore, in part because they're read through local traditions, whether it's Catholicism in Poland, whether it's humanist traditions in Czechoslovakia. They really bring out these other elements that are lost in the migration westward.
So it seems almost that to once again place it, contextualize it historically once again. I mean, when we're speaking of Husserl and when we're speaking of that era of phenomenology, we're speaking of two world wars, right? The destruction of, I guess, you know, this is the thing that everyone says, but the sort of the final destruction of absolute values and finally saying, look, utopian projects fail. And so Husserl is possibly seen as this archaic remnant of someone who is still trying to hold on to objective values. So the split is, so he's sort of caught up in the moment of at the point in time when people are saying, look, actually, utopian objective values are failing. So why are we holding on to this? And then there's a split between the, how do we sort of preserve some semblance of order? Perhaps this is a bit of conjecture, but how do we preserve some semblance of order? And the split seems to be between, as you've said, a sort of return to Catholicism or more traditional modes of understanding phenomenology on the one hand, or a humanitarianism and activism primarily in the East on the other hand. Would I be right in... The split probably isn't that clear cut, but it's there.
No, you're right, actually. And I think there's a lot, of course, tied up into that. The Catholic reception of phenomenology, as Ed Bering shows, begins at the very start of it. In Eastern Europe, it's most prominent in Poland, right? So it's not a Catholic reception. There is a Catholic reception in the Czech Republic, but the prominent reception of phenomenology is more philosophical and non-Catholic. And you're also right about the issue of objective values. And in some ways, so early on, from the very beginning, Husserl's logical investigations is picked up and sometimes criticized, sometimes embraced across parts of Eastern Europe, and which were, of course, in many cases, in this point, old Austria-Hungary, right? So Prague, he has a reception in Prague, and Husserl is engaged here. And there, the engagement is with former Brentanians who are often asking, is Husserl betraying Brentano? Is he carrying forward Brentano's legacy? You have some early reception from in Poland, mostly associated with Roman Ingarden, that is not religious per se, but philosophical, right? And you have, so that's also, my book does not deal with that per se, though there's another excellent collected volume edited by Witold Płotka, who's a Polish philosopher, that goes into the early reception of it. So there is this early reception. I would add the one more thing to this. Husserl himself is aware of the difficulties of pinning down objective values. Remember that Husserl is partly in debates at the time with neo-Kantians, who are sort of the, in German philosophy in the pre and interwar period, who are sort of the main competitors for the mantle of the most prominent philosophy. And again, there, the question is how to sort of pin down knowledge. The objectivity of knowledge is of course, one of the things he's after. And he's concerned about, you know, concerns about idealism associated with neo-Kantianism. Can we really pin down knowledge if it's tied to human consciousness? He's concerned with questions of relativism associated with historicism, in his age, associated with psychologism. So there is this question of how to pin down knowledge. At the same time, and I think this is one of the reasons why it's hard to, Husserl is very much a philosopher's philosopher, and it's often hard when you move outside of phenomenological circles into circles of cultural theories for people to grapple with him too much. He's a tortured writer often. I mean, Husserl writes extraordinarily long tomes in difficult language. You can tell that he is often unsure, often tortured. He published reams and reams. I mean, the Husserliana series is, can't remember how many volumes, up into the 30s. They're all massive, of attempts to grapple with particular subjects, introductions to phenomenology, reintroductions to phenomenology, reintroductions to phenomenology, all in a very difficult language. I often think about this in contrast to Heidegger. Heidegger writes like a sorcerer, right, in many ways, right? You can get caught up in his language. And I think that's part of the appeal. I mean, he's a profound thinker. He's also a very, his language can really sort of mesmerize people. That's not Husserl. Husserl is a bear to read. And in different phases, there are struggles with reading him. He seems to contradict himself, right? There's the initial logical Husserl. Then there's the idealist Husserl of Ideas Forward, where he talks about the constitution of the world. There's an enormous cottage industry of debates about whether there are phases in Husserl or whether there is continuity. All this makes him really hard to grapple with. So on the one hand, yes, he wants to pin down knowledge. On the other hand, he himself can never pin down anything. and it's often worth noting, and it's worth noting, though, that one of the most widely read, I mean, outside of philosophical and phenomenological circles, one of the most widely read works by Husserl is the Crisis of the European Sciences, which is written, there again, like always with Husserl, there's several versions of it, but there's Vienna lecture, there's Prague lecture. These are written in the early 30s when he is despondent about the state of Europe and about what he sees around him. And he argues that science has somehow cut itself loose from human experience, what he called the life world, right? And basically it confronts most human beings as this incomprehensible technical field that controls their lives, but that they can't understand. Mm. And so you have a lot of people, and this is obviously very pertinent now, you know, elites who are speaking a jargon that no one can understand were cut loose from, you know, local experience. My experience seems to count for little. Human experience seems to count for little. How do we somehow bring back knowledge so that it can be comprehensible and in the service of a kind of human life world? This becomes his project, to map out life world, that is to try to understand human experience and how technical science can be seen not as a somehow outside force that just imposes itself on them, but as a tool that is a part and parcel of human life, right? And that becomes his project in the end. And in that sense, is he after objective knowledge? Yes. Does he view himself as kind of grounding in empirical science? Yes. But he sees himself as, I think, throughout his phenomenological project, as trying to say that, you know, for empirical science to work, for empirical science to be properly grounded, we really need to map out experience. We need to grant legitimacy to human experience and understand how science and objective knowledge emerges from it and relates to it. Right? Without that understanding, it's just like this massive mechanical force that controls people's lives and that they feel they lack all control. So empirical, yes, but empirical in the sense of let's legitimate, valorize, understand and map out experience, right? And that becomes ever more pressing as his life proceeds and as the political scene darkens.
So
tell me if I'm going on too long.
No, not at all. So would you say that it's from that understanding of the sciences as being this sort of overmind technical force which has no real connection to life is where the social, the problem of social renewal is found within phenomenology where it begins? Or are those two separate things?
That's a major core of it. So actually, it's not only in the early 30s that Husserl raises this question of social and ethical renewal. Coming out of World War One, so Husserl, like a lot of German thinkers, is animated by World War One and provides, and in late 1917, delivers some lectures on Fichte that have these national overtones, like a lot of German thinkers. But coming out of the war, he loses a son, right? His son is killed in the war. Mm-hmm. And coming out of the war, he is despondent about the situation of Germany and the situation of the globe. And he wrote a series of essays for a Japanese journal called Kaiser, which translates as renewal.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, some of the early international travels of phenomenology were to Japan. So there was some early Japanese interest in it, right? So Japanese modernization in the late 19th century involved, of course, sending students out across the Western world, and some came to Germany. So he published a series of essays on renewal,
mm-hmm.
right? Where he doesn't fully flesh out this kind of question of the life world yet, but he's asking questions about the relationship between science and experience, science and human life, and arguing that we need some kind of renewal that connects the two again. Here you see this Cartesian problem again, right? Subject-object division, mm-hmm. and he wants to bring them together. I mean, there's that Brentanian root, that Brentanian kernel of trying to bring trying to present the object world not as simply this thing out there that's over and against us, that is an obstacle that we have to overcome or that will overcome us, but rather that we are embedded in a world, and only by understanding that context, that world in which we are embedded, that is not just an isolated eye, but that is an eye engaged in things, working with things, right? Only in that context can we somehow come to feel at home again in mm-hmm. the world. That is picked up among others. When I start to lay it out like that, hopefully it becomes clear that there's a lot of Heidegger in early Husserl, right? With Heidegger's notion of Dasein in tools. I mean, you can trace some of these things back to Husserl's concern with the life world, right? Heidegger is already working on this. I mean, Husserl's writing in the early 20s, of course, Being in Time comes out in late 20s for Heidegger, but there are elements that can be found in Husserl of this sense that we need to overcome this divide between the subject and the world, right? That gets carried forward for Husserl. It gets picked up in a very prominent way by Czech thinker, particularly Jan Patočka, who is the dominant philosopher of the mid to late 20th century in Czechoslovakia, in Prague, who is deeply concerned. So his concern is often with the kind of mechanical or machine-like nature of ideologies, right? The way that whether it is Soviet communism or indeed Western consumer capitalism, these are almost like machines that use and use up, to use a Heideggerian phrase, that sort of utilize human beings rather than tools for them to live in. And so Patočka, too, is very concerned with the mechanization of the world through ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And Patočka blends Heidegger and Husserl, but with, once again, sort of trying to recover what he calls care for the soul, going back to sort of ancient thought. But it is, again, this sense of a valorization of human experiences as legitimate, as worthy of understanding and concern. So yes, I mean, and that is essential. This becomes an ethical project, but this also becomes an activist project, right? For anyone who reads Havel, and Havel was drawn to phenomenology. He declared that he picked up he says that he's a thinker who imbibed more the atmosphere of phenomenology and existentialism than actual principles. But he picked it up from an early work by Patočka, about the natural world, I'm not remembering the precise title, but the natural world is in effect a revision of Husserl's life world, right? This idea of a world in which humans live an experience that is often lost in an attempt to create sort of ideologically or mechanically or economically kind of perfect systems. Havel picks this up, and much of his writings, even in The Power of the Powerless, is talking about, you know, the voice of being, the voice of ethics. And that's straight from phenomenology, and existentialism that he imbibes through Patočka.
And that's where, would you say that's where, I mean, it was really interesting to read in your book about this idea of phenomenology as a dissident philosophy, because, I mean, how phenomenology is often taught, there's, you know, you just... in terms of, you know, as you said, the Husserlian bear-like tomb, like bearing through a Husserlian tomb, there was no chance you'd think this is a dissident philosophy. But is that where it really begins for you?
Yes. I mean, in fact, it's really interesting in this regard. And here's where the history of phenomenology dovetails with the history of Marxism. In so many intriguing ways, there are similarities. What I described about phenomenology being picked up by numerous forgotten thinkers and often picked up by people who are not philosophers, and like Havel, and incorporated into a more activist movement. The same, of course, could be said for Marxism, which is striking, right? I mean, to tell the history of Marxism, it's not just the history of Marx, Engels, Kautsky, Lenin, these big thinkers. It gets picked up and adopted and perverted and distorted and selectively received by all sorts of thinkers, right? One of those receptions, of course, is from Lenin into the kind of a kind of hardened materialism of Soviet communism, right? What dissidents and East Europeans often call really existing socialism, as opposed to the more nuanced Marx, you know, thought of Marx and other prominent thinkers. Phenomenology is a reaction to that, in part because what do they confront? They see themselves as confronting in Stalinism, or even if the less virulent forms, the kind of the rigid sclerotic Marxism of the 60s and 70s, they see a kind of ideological machine that makes no room for human, you know, human variability, human nuance, right? You have to fit into the, you know, what does Diema, dialectical materialism, say is the appropriate form? Well, you have to, of course, follow that. Otherwise, you're a victim of false consciousness. To render this simplistically, right? What phenomenology seems to offer is this rich tool for tapping into and valorizing human experience, right? And in that sense, it seems to be the psychological opposite and the philosophical opposite of Marxism. And that's why it is so potent, right? It grants this tool for richly legitimizing, valorizing, and analyzing human life and the life world, as against what seems like just the archaic mechanical machine of dialectical materialism, which lays it out just so bluntly and seems to have so little psychological insight. It's important to note, though, that in part this reception, Marxism and phenomenology were by no means always opposed. Certainly in the French tradition, when you get into existentialism, you see them blended. But even in Eastern Europe, so there were a series of thinkers in the 60s, and I'm focusing here particularly on Czechoslovakia, that were known as Marxist humanists. Karel Kosík is the leading figure here. Dialectic of the Concrete, I'm not remembering the book title precisely. But what he does is he tries to take a more nuanced Marxism, right? A Marxism that embraces that kind of humanist early Marx that was received after the 30s, and blend it with what he sees as the kind of philosophical and psychological insights of phenomenology mm-hmm. and existentialism. And so he draws on Husserl, draws on Heidegger, and says, phenomenology can enrich Marxism because it gives us a much richer understanding, a much fuller understanding of how humans interact with the world around them, of how human consciousness works. It doesn't contradict Marx. It broadens Marx because Marx also, right? I mean, in his view, the Marxian category of work is essential, right? Understanding human labor and human work is critical for Marx, as it is for Kosick. But what Kosick tries to do is draw on Heidegger, draw on Husserl, ask, hey, look, this question of labor is not just a scientific category. It's not just an economic category. It's an experiential category. Work is central to how humans define themselves. I mean, we can go back into the Marxist, we can go back to Hegel, master and slave, right? And note that that's an intensely psychological, intensely social activity, work is. And Kosick and other Marxist humanists, Ivan Svitak and others, try to draw on phenomenology to help them do this, to enrich this category. Patochka is engaged in this for a time in the 60s, so he knows Kosick, he knows these circles, and by the 70s, you know, after the collapse of the project, after the Soviet invasion, he's despairing, of course, that this can work. But all the same, yes, I mean, these are intense, phenomenology is able to bring a dimension to East European thought that is intensely social, intensely ethical, right? But that is rooted, as I hope I've been able to clarify to an extent, but is rooted in Husserl's and Heidegger's own thought right, about the role of experience and about the way that science can become detached from human life so that it looks like a kind of, you know, a force that's oppressing us rather than a kind of tool.
There's a couple of questions there, and I think they might even be connected. And one is, of course, you know, why is it that you've mentioned Heidegger a lot? I mean, he's sort of crept into our conversation in the same way he creeps into the history of phenomenology when we're talking about phenomenology. Right. So on the one hand, there's this one question of why does Heidegger get center stage? But on the other hand, I feel this might be connected to a question of, was this actually a success in the sense that these thinkers thought it was going to be, in this humanitarian activist sense? You know, maybe that's why Heidegger came out on top, because his philosophy isn't really targeted towards any, you know, it moves away from a lot of the, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but it moves away from a lot of the more human-centered parts of phenomenology at points.
He does when he, you know, in his later career, when he drifts into the question of being, right? We sort of lose the, what is surely the more phenomenological early Heidegger of being.
Well, and he's always keen to emphasize that, yes, Dasein might be us, but it's not right. Just us, right? It's this other thing.
Exactly. I mean, you're right. Heidegger tends to take over things. And one of the things I tried to do in my book is really is downplay him to an extent and play up the importance of Husserl. I do think this is an important corrective. I think Husserl had a more powerful effect, both philosophically and indeed socially and ethically, than is often granted to him. And the East European thinkers, I think, really showed that. There's no question that Patochka engaged with Heidegger. But Patochka wrote a whole book called An Introduction to Husserl. Patochka was constantly engaging with Husserl's thought in a way that French existentialist thinkers and French post-structuralist thinkers were not. So if they often cut their teeth on Husserl, they engaged throughout their careers with Heidegger. That same trajectory cannot be said in Eastern Europe, where Husserl was a constant companion, where Husserl's sort of life world philosophy, which by the way was initially developed in part through the good offices of Patochka. Patochka helped to shepherd this into a conference in 1932 in Prague that Husserl couldn't attend, And so Pantochka was intimately and personally involved in that project, the Husserls, and I think he carried that sort of ethical message throughout his career, one that came from Husserl, not Heidegger. And Pantochka himself was always concerned, I think, with the question, yes, with the question of being, but also with the question of sort of human experience, human transcendence, human. He talks about three human movements, care for the human soul, that is more Husserl than Heidegger. And so I do think the East European story shows up, the central role of Husserl as an ethical thinker, in a way that the French story does not. There's a very different reception in Poland I think is, you also have Heidegger coming in, but there the crucial figure is Scheler. And Scheler's an extreme, Max Scheler is an extremely intriguing and powerful figure in his day. So he died prematurely in 1928, but in the teens and 20s, he certainly was not the founder of phenomenology. That was clearly Husserl, but he was easily one of its most prominent celebrities. He was a figure who a whole generation of phenomenological thinkers looked to. He was in a way the one who was most active, most potent, and most overt in taking phenomenology in a social direction. He wrote about ethics of phenomenology. He wrote a phenomenological book about sympathy. He wrote a phenomenological book, you know, sort of condemning capitalism and modern liberalism. Very obvious and overt in saying that what phenomenology allows is for us to look at the world again. Mm-hmm. It allows for us to return to the world, back to the things itself. And a generation of thinkers, Edith Stein, Adolf Reinach, Dietrich von Hildebrand, embraced that. For them, phenomenology was what they called realist phenomenology, a phenomenology that could be used to analyze law, government, social movements, art, the Roman Ingard, obviously ethics, capitalism. In ways that Husserl was sometimes uncomfortable with. So when Husserl made his idealist turn, arguing for the sort of idealist constitution of the world, many of these, this first generation of phenomenological thinkers felt utterly betrayed by him. He was a break from neo-Kantian idealism. He was a break from Hegel, and yet now he's returning to it. And Scheler was the one who, in effect, becomes the leading light of this realist movement. Scheler also, and this is critical to his embrace in Poland, Scheler, of course, converts to Catholicism, right? And he binds his phenomenology up with his Catholic thinking, arguing, among other things, that eidetic insight, the ability to sort of see into things, the ability to return to things, is also tied with a recuperation of faith, and an ability to sort of return to faith in God. And again, thinker after thinker does just this, right? And there's this kind of extraordinary movement of conversion from, especially Judaism, to Catholicism. Husserl himself is a Lutheran, but Adolf Reinach converted to, I think, Lutheranism too. Dietrich von Hildebrand, Aulo Kolnai, all these figures who have sort of Jewish backgrounds convert to Catholicism. And in numerous cases, that religious conversion and the philosophical conversion to a kind of phenomenology are of a piece, right? They're of a piece. That, of course, is central to the reception in Poland, where, so there's a series of thinkers, lesser known figures, who start to write about how phenomenology can be this rebirth of Christian faith. And here, Ed Bering's book is really crucial. Ed Bering traces it westward, but you can also find it in Yugoslavia. You can find it among German writers and others, that they say that, look, phenomenology grants us a way to sort of ground faith in kind of essential insight, an insight into the nature of things, and an insight into human psychology that says, and here's where Wojtyla, who becomes Pope John Paul II, will pick this up, that a study of human experience reveals that, you know, a sort of human being is fully human if they devote themselves to higher objective values. That's straight shading. And those values ultimately merge into the kind of religious, right? And so for Shaler, as for Voiture, sort of Christian communities of faith become sort of ideal communities. Voiture's trajectory, so Karol Voiture, who was the Polish thinker and priest, who of course becomes bishop, archbishop, and then pope, mm-hmm. right? His reception is really fascinating. So he studies in the Angelicum in Rome in the years just after World War II with an arch-Thomist, a guy who's very critical of the incorporation of modern philosophies into Catholic thought, right? And yet at the same time as he's getting this arch-Orthodox message from Garrigou-Lagrange, right? At the same time as he's getting this message, he's interested in the worker priest movement in France and Belgium. Voiture himself starts taking an interest in modern philosophies and starts taking an interest in the role of human experience in faith. So not just doctrine handed down, but what is the role of human experience? So he writes a dissertation on Teresa of Avila that really foregrounds the analysis of human experience. He's interested in these worker priests who, of course, trying to devise new methods for engaging with workers in the Francophone Europe. At this and over time, he's introduced to Shaler, right? This Catholic thinker who, and it's not sure exactly who introduced him to Shaler, but at any rate, he comes upon Shaler's work on objective values, and initially decides after a second dissertation, so a Habilitationsschrift, that Shaler's philosophy doesn't work for Christian faith. What he's trying to do is see if Shaler's philosophy can help bolster Christian faith, can help bring people closer, just as the worker priests were trying to devise methods for bringing workers to Catholicism. So he's asking, you know, can Shaler's phenomenology of experience and of objective values and of ethics help bring doubters to the faith? Mm. And he concludes no, right? Then Vatican II happens, and he's engaged in Vatican II. And he starts, despite his earlier, I mean, he's sympathetic enough, of course, even early on to do a thorough dissertation analyzing it, but still he concludes no. Nonetheless, in Vatican II, he starts writing these tracts that saying, hey, look, we need to bring doctrine into alignment with modern life experience, with the way that human, you know, the church is outdated, and unless we somehow meet people where they are in their modern experience, it's going to be hard for the church to, you know, rejuvenate itself, to win new converts and the like. And in this regard, he starts incorporating Shalerian language of community, of bonding with other people. So Shaler emphasizes community and personalism, the attempt to sort of bond with others, as well as bonding with higher values. Voiture starts embracing this. He writes several interpretive books about, he writes an interpretive book about Vatican II, in which he tries to explain how Vatican II meets modern human beings at this point of experience. He writes his main work on philosophy called The Acting Person, which is shot through with Shalerian and phenomenological thought. And by the time he becomes archbishop, he writes articles that are filtered through a phenomenologist named Anna Timonietska. So that may have had an effect, but nonetheless, he declares that, yeah, I mean, look, phenomenology brings this ability to understand the riches of human experience that church doctrine needs. In that regard, yeah, I'm a phenomenologist. I bring an understanding of human experience to church doctrine because church doctrine just has to be enriched by that if it's to remain relevant. And so there's this trajectory from Shaler through an initial dismissal and an ultimate embrace by Voiture that profoundly affects sort of Polish thought, right? Because of course, once he's Archbishop of Krakow, he's a very prominent figure engaged with the dissident community and with Solidarity in particular. And with the Workers' Defense Committee, or KOR. And so there are other thinkers in the area who, he also teaches philosophy during his time as Archbishop. And so other thinkers have, you know, sometimes superficial, but nonetheless brushes with Husserl and with phenomenology through his work, right? And so some of the figures associated with Solidarity, Mischnik and others are quite familiar with Husserl, in part because of these circles at the time. Do they have rich engagements with them? No. Are they aware, and do they start adopting vocabulary of phenomenology? Yeah. And certainly in church circles, the figure of Josef Tischner is very definitely a phenomenologist who looks to Heidegger, Scheler, and Husserl. And Tischner becomes what is often called the unofficial priest of solidarity, working with them closely in 80, 81, during their heyday. And of course, by this point, Wojtyla is the Pope, and he provides both attention and some protection to the movement. So in that regard, you have this really different version of phenomenology, but nonetheless one that is powerfully activist, ethical, community oriented, that is embraced in Poland through Catholicism. So it's a different trajectory from the Czechoslovak reception, but nonetheless one that highlights the ethical and social dimensions.
Mm-hmm. So did this, you know, the Catholic reception of, you know, with the Pope being himself sort of a phenomenologist of a sort.
Self-declared, yeah.
Does that affect the, you know, the Marxist, well, our reception of, say, Marxist phenomenology or communist phenomenology? Is it sort of, does the Catholic reception sort of overshadow that?
I think politically it does. I mean, Marxist humanism, there's more work to be done on this. In fact, there's a Czech scholar named Ivan Landa who is trying to work to revive interest in the sort of philosophical, the Marxist humanists of the 60s, who came into English through the journal Telos, mm-hmm. which was a journal run by Paul Picon in the 60s and 70s and published a lot of East European thinkers and a lot of East European Marxists and a lot of East European phenomenological Marxists from Poland, from Czechoslovakia, from Hungary, right, George Marcus. Yeah, it overshadowed it in part, of course, because I think after 68 and certainly after 81, right, the trajectory of Marxism, of global Marxism, was sort of downward, right? I mean, it was just not a philosophy that was embraced. I see this in my own teachings, right? I mean, there was just a lack of interest in Eastern Europe, a lack of interest in Marx and the like after 91. I mean, he was thinker non grata, mm-hmm. right? That's changed recently. I mean, obviously, we've seen a revival of interest in various forms of socialism in the history of Eastern Europe with Putin and the like. And so I still think there's a considerable amount of work to do on what role Marxist humanism played after, you know, the 60s and 70s that was its heyday. But one thing I will say is this. I think it's tempting to see phenomenology as opposed to Marxism. I don't think the historical record bears that out. Mm-hmm. I think there are too many cases where Marxism and phenomenology blended together, whether it's French thinkers, whether it's East European thinkers. There's obviously cases where, you know, they sort of fueled activism. If you go back into the 30s, Mounier and others who could blend aspects of this. And I think the dissidents themselves had a very healthy regard for not really existing socialism in Eastern Europe, but for Marx himself as a thinker. Havel and Charter 77, the Czech dissident movement, embraced fallen humanist socialism. Jiří Hájek, who had been the Marxist humanist foreign minister in the Prague Spring, he joined Charter 77. There were numerous Marxist humanists that joined it. Patočka himself was sympathetic to the criticisms of inequality and of colonialism that you got from Marx and Lenin, even as he condemned the way that Marxism had degenerated into a kind of mechanical philosophy, as he saw. In Poland, you have a bit of a stronger reaction against it. So Tischner was a staunch critic of Marxism, in part there because you have the added concern of Marxist atheism. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the atheist question came up. But there's also work on, there's also recent work showing, you know, Catholic Marxist blends. I mean, work of Piotr Kozitsky shows this in the 50s. Wojtyla, as Archbishop, of course, was critical of the authorities. He also had to sort of work with them to a certain extent. So, so I think it's a much more, I think it's a more complicated relationship than mere opposition. And I do wonder now, I still think some of the social dividends of phenomenology, this sort of emphasis on experience, have sort of rich potential, right? But I also wonder now with the recovery of certain aspects of socialism that we see in politics in the US and in Europe, if there might be, you know, if that sort of overlap, that sort of blend that one saw in the 60s might be recuperated in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, you've been extremely articulate to the point where a lot of the questions have been answered very well and very quickly. So I'll open the floor to you. If there's anything about your book in particular that you feel my questions missed or that we've missed, is there anything there that you feel you'd like to add in?
Oh, James, that's the one question I wasn't prepared to answer. By the way, that was the same thing that happened in my orals that I began this whole thing with. They ended with one of my orals examiners said, so you've done well so far at the end, what would you like in this last, what would you like to talk about? And that just got me. I was flubbed it. So I guess my answer would be no. I think that you have covered a lot and I appreciate you bringing this in. I will say I think there's a lot of rich work to do in this regard, and it's philosophical work and it's also historical work. I'm glad that you brought in Ed Baring, and I think it was the connection with Ed that came to me. You may know there's a new book about Catholic thinkers by Sarah Shortall that Ed has helped to the one thing I haven't been articulate on is I can't remember a single title. So it has Catholic Soldiers in a Secular World, Soldiers for God in a Secular World. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it is. It just came out. And I mean, I think what we're seeing is there's a number of historical trends that I think we're seeing. And I think a lot of them are tied to the recuperation of East European archives and the attempt to stitch together the history of the continent. One, I would say, is this realization that phenomenology was more than just an esoteric backdrop to later philosophies. Two, we are, I think, realizing the significant importance of Catholic thinkers and religious thinkers in a supposedly secular 20th century. I think that just comes up again and again. Maybe that's my two. I was going to say that, I guess the third, we're recognizing that I think, we cannot treat East European and West European schools of thought as somehow separate because they so often blended together. Yes, they had distinctions. Yes, they had uniquenesses. Yes, they had different perspectives, but there is this sort of, rich transnational thought history that is only beginning to be written.
Do you think we're possibly seeing the pendulum of, which began to swing the other way from Husserl when he was looking into objective values? Do you think, we've swung past the point where we've perhaps become bored of denouncing objective values and it's actually swinging back towards that Husserlian position of we need to start looking, we need to start looking for some objective values again?
I do. I would put it in a different way. I think that the sort of post-structuralism that dominated a lot of the era of my own training, but that was, I think, ebbing at that point, we've shifted away from that back to questions of ethical and political questions. And I see this in a number of ways, and I'll just speak to my own intellectual history discipline and my own crop of intellectual historians. Many of us are moving from questions, from analyses of particular thinkers into questions about how ideas have, how political ideas, whether it's human rights, terrorism, international development, how these have evolved and developed, right? In doing that, we're embracing a set of prominent thinkers, some of whom were influenced by phenomenology, but who also were very overt in their political connections. I'm thinking, for example, of Hannah Arendt, mm-hmm. right? Clearly schooled in phenomenology, and yet was very concerned about sort of political aspects. You know, and Levinas is another one who has come back. And I mean, these are figures who have phenomenological roots, and yet were very open about trying to ask questions that they would have called political theory questions rather than philosophical questions about being, right? And I think we are moving in that direction. Partly it's, you know, trying to investigate the roots of post-structuralism, right, which takes us back to phenomenology. But it's also, you know, I mean, obviously, the post-Cold War euphoria is gone. And I think that political and social concerns of polarization are driving some of this. And right, what I would just say is almost like a difficulty in imagining alternatives to the world, to the political and social world we live in. And I think a lot of intellectual historians are turning back to say, look, we can't just deconstruct things. We have to look, we have to broaden our imagination by going elsewhere. And that was partly what I did. I mean, I framed the book by saying, look, you know, I mean, we treated East European dissidents and the East European revolutions as like a liberal vanguard. They want to be like us. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of American and West triumphalism. And yet they were drawing on this tradition of phenomenology that was in the hands of East European thinkers. Just look at Pope John Paul II's encyclical, look at Patochka, where profoundly critical of Western capitalism, Western industrialization, and Western liberalism, just as they were profoundly critical of communism. And so it was missing the native tradition that drove these, and at the same time was allowing us to get off easy. We won. We were right. Right? That's not the dissidents. That's not what they thought. And so that was part of what drove me. I think the other thing that we're doing, the other direction that thought is going, is fairly obvious, but is more global, right? More transnational, moving beyond just the standard thinker, you know, the sort of high thinkers that have been treated historically, Heidegger or others, and trying to discover other thinkers, trying to move into Eastern Europe and recover forgotten figures, trying to move beyond Europe itself and asking how, you know, embrace a phenomenology by Japanese or Koreans or the like might affect it, right? I think these are also projects that are happening. And I think a lot of it has to do with the social questions of our day, right? What are the lacuna that we've missed? Why can we not imagine alternatives to the problems that we find now, right? Are there alternatives rooted in history? Are there alternatives elsewhere from the normal corners that we've looked at?
Anyway. So you say you're working on a new book. Is this what you're focusing on, or is it something completely
Yes, actually. It's both something completely different and what I'm focusing on. So it is a history of ahistoricism and international development. So theory and practice. So aid projects overseas. It too, by the way, interestingly comes out of some of this. So after getting my PhD, I went through a fruitful period of academic unemployment where I worked for a contractor that ran education projects overseas. And that changed my research trajectory. So I've also been researching, you know, conceptions of development, conceptions of modernization, developed in the West, but applied, of course, in Africa, Latin America. Part of my argument is, so it's an argument that, the argument is that, in a nutshell, is that there's often a dismissal of history and an application of technical programs, technical solutions to poverty that ignores local history. And part of my argument is this overlooks local experience that is absolutely essential. And unless, you know, sort of projects dovetail with experience in certain ways, A, they may not work. B, we're also really overlooking potential valuable insights that could be gleaned in Kenya or Laos or wherever we happen to be working, right? A greater awareness of context, experience, and local history can help there. That also comes out of my early Regal book, which was an argument against. So there was a prominent book on Vienna written by Karl Shorsky that argued that Viennese culture was ahistorical. And I said, no, there was a lot of concern for history. And so here I am arguing you need more concern for history and international development. So it's I'm repeating these concerns about experience and history just in a very different domain. So different, but oddly repetitive.
Mm-hmm. And when do you know when that's going to be released?
Well, that's the book that I'm hoping to have an almost complete draft of at the end of this academic year. So I'm at the I have one chapter yet to do because I have to travel overseas and we've been in COVID. So, but beyond that chapter, and of course the introductory conclusion was always the last thing written, I hope to have a working draft by say June, and I'm already sort of talking with presses. I mean, realistically speaking, what does that mean? That means it's a couple of years out, because once it goes to press, it still takes a while. But still, by the time a book comes out, it's typically been out of the author's hands for a few years. But it feels like it's nearing, like the end of the tunnel is in sight.
Okay.
Yeah, but there are bits out already. There are bits and pieces that are already circulating. So, cool. So yeah.
Okay. Whereabouts?
I cannot escape phenomenology. Go ahead.
Yeah. Speaking of which, whereabouts can we find The Far Reaches? So it's published by Stanford.
Stanford. You can find it basically anywhere. It's on Amazon, which is the obvious thing, which means it's basically anywhere. Academic bookstores, but the easiest is Amazon and other online booksellers, which you can get it. There's both paperback and hardback. You can, tell your libraries to get it. Mm-hmm. I think the paperback is now affordable, right? The hardbacks never are. It's readily available on Amazon and any bookseller sense.
Okay. That seems like a good place to finish up. Yep. Michael Goobson.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Thank you.